You're listening to EPN, the E-Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Hope Gibbs with the Incandescent Radio Show here on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. We are here today with Michael Levin, one of the most established ghostwriters in the nation. The New York Times said he is named him a best-selling author. He has written and co-written and ghostwritten more than 100 books, of which 9 are national bestsellers. He's appeared on ABC's Shark Tank in January 2012. So we're here almost a year later to talk with Michael about his books, ghostwriting, the power of writing books, and his most recent article about why publishers lie. So let's get started with some basic background on you, Michael. How did you get into the ghostwriting business?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for having me on the program. As you mentioned, I'm a lawyer by training, went to Columbia Law School, was working for 2 firms in Boston, and the feeling was kind of mutual. I didn't like being there, and they didn't like having me. I left the law almost as quickly as I got into it. And by the time I was out, I'd sold 3 novels to Simon & Schuster, and within a few more years, I had run through all the advances on all those books and was literally a starving writer. I was below the poverty line in Massachusetts, and on heating assistance, and I didn't like that at all. This is at the same time my classmates were making partner at major firms in New York and Boston, and I met a man who became my mentor in business, and he's still my mentor to this day, almost 19 years later. He taught me how to offer writing classes to start a business around writing. He said, I've worked with a lot of you creative people. You cannot do your best work when you're worried about how you're going to put bread on the table. And he showed me how to start a business which was offering writing classes privately. I rented space in a yoga studio and then a church. And from there, the business quickly expanded. I shouldn't say quickly, but eventually expanded to people saying, coach me or consult with me. And then finally people said, write my book for me. And one day I did the numbers and I realized I was making a lot more money ghostwriting than anything else. So I still coach writers, but that's kind of how I backed into ghostwriting. And here we are 100, 120 books later. And, this turns out to be the thing that I'm doing in life. So there you are.
Oh, very interesting. And you've done some books for some pretty notable people, Doug and Jackie Christie, No Ordinary Love, Million Dollar Dentistry with Jerry Cady, Where's My 15 Minutes with Howard Bragman. Tell us about some of the big names that you've worked with and if that's a real focus of yours or you do that plus other things.
Yeah, we do that plus other things. I've had the privilege of working with some really, really amazing people, the ones you mentioned. Also, Dave Winfield, Baseball Hall of Famer, football broadcasting legend Pat Summerall, Zig Ziglar, who recently passed away. I had the privilege of editing his last book. Michael Gerber, who wrote The E-Myth. I could go on and on. I've worked with a lot of really amazing folks. Howard Bragman, as you mentioned, is one of the top, or maybe the top publicists in Hollywood. So we do get to do a lot of really fun books. David Fishoff, Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. We have a book called Rock Your Business that just came out and it quickly became a bestseller. So I do get to work with a lot of really intriguing people. But in many ways in my business, that's kind of the sizzle. The steak, or what we really do on a constant basis, is that we work with business people. The company's called Business Ghost. And we work with business people who need books that they use as marketing tools for their businesses. So the problem is today that, and I'm sure all the entrepreneurs listening will identify with this, that the internet tends to turn everyone into a commodity judged primarily or entirely on price. And if you're going to live by competing on price, you're going to die by it because someone will come along and undercut you. So the question is, how do you stand out in a world where everyone's websites kind of look alike, everyone's social media kind of looks the same? How do you really establish trust and preeminence and distinctiveness, and we believe that nothing does that like a book. So we ghostwrite books for financial advisors, for CEOs, for entrepreneurs, for MDs, for body, mind, spirit experts, for pretty much anybody who needs a book as a tool for differentiation in the marketplace. And those books don't end up typically in bookstores. We actually advise our clients to give their books away for free on their websites in exchange for contact information so that people can find them and see. Basically, we say that if people only knew how much you knew, they would hire you. What's the best way to get people to realize that you are the authority. It's for you to be an author. So that's what we do at Business Ghost. We take folks and we turn them into authors.
Interesting. So what's the return on investment? How much does an average book that you ghostwrite cost, and what can they expect to receive from it?
That's a great question. It varies. We do mini books for around $16,500, and we do full-size books for $45,000 to $65,000 and up, and sometimes way up depending on the length or complexity of the book. Typically, our clients are able to monetize their books almost immediately. I mean, the classic example is a guy named Randy Hammond, who is a financial advisor, and we did a book for him. He was on the radio with his book. Someone called him from the state of Texas. He got on a plane. He came back with $1 million under management and a $40,000 commission check. So he basically paid off his book on that first call. And sometimes it takes a few sales calls. But what our clients find is that, first of all, their stature increases radically as a result of being an author. Second is that people are trying to get on their schedules instead of the other way around, so their marketing becomes considerably easier. A book as a marketing tool is a force multiplier, because instead of having to say the same thing over and over and over to prospects, the book says it for you 24/7, 365. We typically tell our clients, to give the book away for free on their website in exchange for contact information. So they're able to build up a huge list simply by using the book as a free gift, and then they're able to market to that list and get them into their funnel and sell them all kinds of services. The one thing we tell our clients is you're not going into the book business. The book business is a bad business. The book business is a dying business. You're using your book to build your business. We want you to be a best earning author. We're less concerned about whether you achieve bestseller status. You can have a bestseller that makes no money. That's one of the strange paradoxes of the publishing industry. The publisher might make money, but the author typically doesn't make all that much. We'd rather see you, we'll say to our clients, what's it worth to you to bring in one or two new clients? What is a new client worth to you over the course of, say, a year or 18 months? And typically for our clients, it does not take very many new clients to pay off the book, and then now they can go out and get speaking. You run a speakers bureau, and you'll most likely agree with me that it's a lot easier to book speaking engagements, especially high-end lucrative ones, for people who have books as opposed to people who don't. So that's another benefit.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the book publishing industry. You wrote an article that we published on incandescentnetworking.com, which is the daily to our monthly business magazine, Be Incandescent. You were talking about why publishers lie. So why do publishers lie to authors about book sales?
Why do publishers lie? Because they can. The simple reality is that publishers have access to data that they will not share with authors. It's all but impossible to get an accurate sales count from a publisher. To illustrate that point, I know a gentleman who calls himself a forensic publishing accountant, and his name is Paul. And what he does for a living is he calls publishers and he says, "Hi, it's Paul." And they say, "Okay, Paul, which book and how much money do you want?" In other words, everybody in the industry knows that the game is rigged in favor of the publishers. They don't have to share information with you. There's no way that an author can go on Amazon and find out how many books Amazon sold, or BarnesandNoble.com, or brick-and-mortar bookstores. Those places don't share that kind of information with the authors. And the publishers have no incentive to provide accurate information to authors, not just in terms of how many books that they sell, but even how the books are sold. For example, let's say your book makes Book of the Month Club. Well, what Book of the Month Club does is that it sends one big check to Simon & Schuster. And then Simon & Schuster will sprinkle a little Book of the Month Club money on a bunch of different titles. So you'll say, "Hey, look at that. I made $227 on the Book of the Month Club. Isn't that great?" Well, the reality is that your book might have made you $15,000 or $100,000, but the publisher gave you $227. And there's no way for you to have any sense of what accuracy is, because they control the numbers. And if you get too pushy as an author, that's going to go on your permanent record, and they're not going to want to do business with you anymore. So there's kind of an omerta that everybody buys into, that mafia-like silence, because it's not in the best interest of an author to be perceived as a troublemaker. So for all these reasons, publishers have no incentive to tell the truth, and so they don't, and they get to keep money that rightfully belongs to the authors.
It's pretty tragic for an author. In fact, just this morning, an email from Guy Kawasaki, who's a pretty well-known author. We've written about several of his books in the magazine. They're very popularly read articles. But he wrote in the email that in 2001, the publisher of one of his books, Enchantment, could not fill an order of 500 ebook copies. And because of this experience, he self-published his current book, What the Plus, which is what it's called. And he learned firsthand that self-publishing is a complex, confusing, and idiosyncratic process. So what do you do? I mean, if Guy Kawasaki can't figure it out, how do you find out about your sales with a publisher? You know, if it is kind of a mafia thing, why do people continue to write books? Clearly, you say it turns into business and selling the book isn't the goal for a lot of your clients. So what's the solution?
Well, there's a lot there to talk about. Erica Jong, she wrote Fear of Flying many years ago. It sold 5 million copies. I once heard her say that Harper & Row, which was the predecessor publisher to HarperCollins, owed her $8,000 for 6 years. Finally, the agent said, hey, you know, where's the money? And they admitted they owed the money. And so they said, you know, what took you so long to pay it? And they said to her, we didn't know where you were. Oh, please. So that was back in the 80s. This has been going on for a long, long time. The solution more and more is that top authors are moving away from the major publishing houses and doing things themselves. There's a guy named Tim Ferriss who just published the 4-Hour Cookbook, and he did it without the majors. He actually published it with Amazon, and Barnes & Noble isn't happy, and I don't know if they're stocking the book in the stores. So he's kind of a pathbreaker in that regard. He wrote The 4-Hour Workweek, which is a classic and a fantastic book, and I've gotten to know Tim a little bit. And so he's taking his own path. There's an author named Tucker Max who writes these really outrageous books about getting drunk and meeting women in bars, and they're really not for a family audience. And his books are incredibly successful. He received million-dollar offers from major publishers, but what he realized was that since they weren't telling the truth about his numbers, the same as with any author, all he wanted was a distribution deal. So he actually turned down seven-figure offers from publishing houses and instead went ahead and negotiated an exceptional and a one-of-a-kind distribution deal with Simon & Schuster. So they're putting his books out in exchange for a small piece of the pie, but he's controlling his own publishing. So people are finding creative ways to do it. The problem for most authors who aren't quite on that level is getting attention for their books. It's very, very easy to publish a book with Kindle or to get it on Amazon. It's easy to do it. You still have the marketing problem, but then you had to market your own book even if Simon & Schuster or Random House brought it out. So that's not a new problem for authors. And the good news is that with social media, with the internet, with blogging, with all the various new technologies at our disposal, it's easier than ever for an author to reach a niche audience. So it's kind of a brave new world for established authors who have looked traditionally to the major publishing houses to do the heavy lifting. But the thing is, today you really have to ask, why would I want a major publisher to eat my lunch and keep 85% of the profits, or 90 or 95 or 100%, and cut me out when I've worked so hard to create the book? And then you ask, why do people keep going to New York? Well, people are naive, and they don't either. They don't know the truth about the publishing industry. They assume that it works on a sort of gentlemanly, honorable basis. They don't realize just how unforgiving and cutthroat it is to authors, or they know that and they say to themselves, "This won't happen to me," but it does every time.
And you're an author. It happened to you?
Sure.
Is that how you got so savvy about this?
Yeah, I mean, you learn. I mean, you know, pain is the greatest teacher. The perfect example, I did a book called Making Jack Falcone, and you and I were talking about it before. The author is Joaquin Garcia. He's a top FBI agent top undercover agent in the history of the FBI. He was inserted into the mafia in Westchester County, New York, and for 2 years, he was 2 weeks away from being made as a member of the mafia. As a result of his undercover work, the FBI and the government were able to secure something like 60 convictions against mafiosi, really high-ranking guys. And the book broke on 60 Minutes and the next morning on CBS This Morning. The book immediately jumped onto the New York Times bestseller list because the guy's fascinating. He's 6'4", 400 pounds. He doesn't look like an FBI agent. He's Spanish. He's actually Cuban. And he convinced the mafia, who could have killed him at any moment, that he was Italian and not FBI. What did Simon & Schuster do as a result of having this potential monster hit on their hands? Nothing. They didn't lift a finger to promote the book, even though it was already on the New York Times bestseller list. It started on 60 Minutes. They did zero. I've seen this happen over and over and over again in the publishing industry with books that I've done as a co-author, with books from some very famous people whom I've gotten to know who had the same problem. The publishing industry, they don't operate in a business like fashion. It's so stovepiped, meaning that the departments don't talk to each other. The editorial department, the people who actually create the books, don't talk to the marketing people. They don't talk to the salespeople. Nobody talks to the art department. Everybody doesn't really, no one cares about what happens when they throw their work over the wall into the next department. As a result, marketing is so fragmented and so poor that, and then also they just put out too many books. You know, I mean, they'll put out 1,000, 2,000 books a year. You cannot adequately market 2,000 products in any field. Look at the major car companies. They'll spend $1 billion before they put a new mark into the marketplace. And then they'll just, you know, everybody knows what a Prius is because Toyota spends so much money making sure you know what a Prius is or a Camry or a Lexus or anything else. The book publishers don't do that. You cannot run a publishing company in a foolish way in terms of marketing and expect to sell books, and that's why they're dying.
That's very true, and a lot of authors come to us very frustrated. They feel like they shouldn't spend money, and they don't know how much it costs to publicize their book and what's the return on investment. And we help a handful of them, but we make it really clear that money's books are loss leaders, and the best way to make money from a book is to have a business behind the book that you're actually selling your service, because that's where the money is, not from the books, which is very, you know, crestfallen to a lot of people who had this fantasy that they'd write a book and be very famous and very rich.
Yeah, and that fantasy, might have been true 30, 40, 50 years ago. The reality today is that people do not want to pay for information in any form. And most people get their information online. If you look something up, you'll go to Wikipedia or a website that provides answers. Typically, you're not looking to books for your answers anymore. It used to be you kept an almanac on your desk, and if you wanted to know, this morning a client and I needed to know how many people enter the military each year, and it's about 250,000. Well, you know, we would have gotten that information from an almanac or some sort of book that we paid money for that we bought in a physical bookstore if this conversation was happening a generation ago. But today you go online, you've got the answer in a split second, and maybe you glance at the ad, maybe you don't. The reality is that it's very, very hard to sell books today because people don't want to pay for information anymore because there's so much quality information available online. And you can say, well, Wikipedia, nobody's in charge. Well, that's true, but the thing is that they did a test and they found that there were fewer errors in Wikipedia entries than there were in World Book entries. So the information that's out there really is pretty good by and large. And if you don't like what you've got, you can look at another 10 sites and kind of triangulate and figure out what's real. So in that kind of world, what do you need a book for? And if you go to a bookstore, you buy a book. You cannot slip it under your arm and walk out of the store without paying. You'll go to jail. But online, information is free. So there's no sense of I'm doing something wrong, I'm stealing. The information is there for you for free. So you're absolutely right. The model for a successful author today is use the book as a means of establishing trust, of demonstrating how much you know, of showing that since you're the author, you must be the authority. But don't try to make money selling books. I always tell people the book business is a bad business. Use the book to build your business. And John Assaroff was in The Secret, and he's one of the people interviewed in that movie, The Secret. And I've gotten to know him a little bit. When he said something really fascinating. He said, charge $25 for the book and then charge $1 million to explain what's in the book. Well, he said that 2 years ago. Today he might be saying give the book away for free, which is what we say. Give the book away for free. Let it get into as many hands as possible in your niche. Don't try to write a book for the mass market. There is no more mass market. Instead, write a book that will serve the needs of your niche. And once you've done that, you can establish yourself as the tribal leader, as Seth Godin says, in your niche. You can sell to them. You're the expert as far as they're concerned. Be the hero to your niche, and then and your niche will make you rich. That's what we tell our clients at Business Ghost.
Yeah, that's an interesting, very interesting philosophy. I think the key to this is writing a book that is good, and I see a lot of books pass through our office that are so much not good. Which is really tragic because it's not helping the author. It's definitely not building their business. In fact, quite the contrary, it's killing their business. So writing well is definitely an art and something that shouldn't be taken lightly.
Now you're saying something incredibly important. And A.J. Liebling said the way to write is well. So that's one of my favorite sort of quotes about writing books. But today the New York publishers are focused on the marketing plan for books. They're not nearly as focused on the contents of a given book. So if you've got a ton of people following you on Facebook, or if you've got a ton of people following you on Twitter, or if you're speaking a lot, you've got a great speakers bureau like yours behind you, and you're speaking in front of a lot of people, and the publisher looks at you and sort of salivates and says, yes, this person can sell a lot of books, you're going to get a book deal, whereas someone perhaps in your field who doesn't have that same national footprint at this time but has much better content, that person's not going to get a deal. As a result, the quality of nonfiction books is dropping precipitously. Are there still good books being published? Yes, but they're further and further between because New York is so fixated on the marketing plan as opposed to the contents. What this means is that if you buy a physical book, you're going to basically get one chapter's worth of information for the price of that physical book. It still has value. You can stick it on your shelf and look smart and imposing when people come to your home or your office. But if you buy that as a download, if you buy it as a book for the Kindle or an ebook or an iBook, at some point you're going to say, hey, I got one chapter of information and 11 chapters of Hamburger Helper. And at some point, to change the metaphor a little bit, you're going to say, why am I paying for the album when I only want the single? And then at some point you're going to say, why am I paying for any of this stuff when I can get the same information for free online? So publishers are definitely not helping their own cause by publishing inferior books. And if you do a book that does not deliver value on every, one of our taglines at Business Ghost is delivering value on every page. If you don't do that, if you do have a book that's just a couple of chapters of two or three ideas stretched out to be 200 pages, at some point people are going to say, this isn't a book. This is a marketing tool, and it's a really bad one. And I don't like the marketing tool, and I don't like the author. And the word of mouth that you're going to get for something like that is far more destructive than never having written a book at all. So, you know, write a good one or don't write a book at all.
Absolutely. And I think the question really is, how do you build business? How do you make money in this new economy? And I think the biggest game changer, the millennials that are changing everything, they have been for a long time, and they will continue to. And most of them don't really sit down and read a book. They may read the classics. They're a thoughtful generation. Our columnists on Be Incandescent magazine who wrote Millennial Momentum talk a lot about this. But I think that that's sort of an interesting element to consider. So how do you deal with that? Is that affecting your business at all?
Well, it doesn't affect what we do at Business Ghost in terms of creating business books as marketing tools for financial advisors and entrepreneurs and CEOs and so on. It changes society in very important ways. It means that if people are not reading books, and by and large, it's a generational thing. You talk to people in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, and older, and they're going to say, oh, I love physical books. I love going to the bookstore. I love browsing. I love reading books. Well, it's a generational thing. Younger people don't feel the same way. They don't feel that sense of attachment and excitement about opening up a brand new book and smelling the ink and feeling the pages and what was the font and all the rest of it. They're used to simply getting their information in the online environment, and they don't need as much information to be satisfied about a topic, and they don't really see the point. When you know, I was talking to a couple of my friends the other day, and one said, I read a really good book, and it said such and such. And the other guy said, well, if all it said was such and such, then why'd you need to read a whole book? And you know, basically, you can summarize most books in a Twitter, in a tweet, and then the rest of the book is just simply proving that the author is credible and proving that the assertion that the author is making is true, and interesting stories and data and footnotes. Well, who needs that if all you need is the assertion? So, what the real problem when we go away from books is not simply that we have a less educated populace. My problem with the millennial generation is the self-obsession. All they care about is their Facebook page. They're not interested in learning new stuff. And I'd like to, you know, how much time do you spend on your Facebook page versus how much time do you spend learning about new topics from books? That's my sort of acid test there. If you're so wrapped up in yourself, then what happens to society is as books go away, we lose an important layer of accountability for business, for the intelligence community, for government, for the military, for all the things that society needs to have a means of keeping an eye on. We're living in an era where newspapers are vanishing because newspaper revenues have gone away because of Craigslist, and people just don't want to pay again for information. You can look at so much free news online. Why would you pay for it? And then at the same time, books go away. Newsweek went away. Books, I believe, are on their way out. This allows these large institutions to basically operate in the dark. If you don't have the Woodward and Bernstein mentality of people going after the powerful and holding them accountable, society suffers in a major, major way. So I think that's the highest cost of having a populace that is not reading books, that is not interested in or even capable of experiencing sustained thought, either someone else's or their own. That's where we pay the price, because a society that isn't all that aware of what's going on is that much easier to control. And then we're going to need our own Arab Spring. So that I think that's the real problem.
Interesting thoughts. Yeah. So what's on tap for you next? What are you working on now?
Oh, gosh. What we're working on now is that we've recognized that financial advisors, stockbrokers, wealth managers, financial planners really are our best market. Out of all the various people, we love everybody, but those are the people who seem to be our best clients. So we have created, we're doing mini books for them, about 50 pages long. We call them briefing books, as a means of attracting attention to themselves. Their biggest problem is that people don't trust anybody who has anything to do with Wall Street since the 2008 meltdown. And then you've simply got too many financial advisors chasing too few potential clients. So the question becomes, if you're a financial advisor, how do you achieve distinctiveness? How do you create trust? And so we're launching a new initiative to offer mini books to financial advisors so that they can achieve that kind of distinctiveness. And we're about to come out with a book that I wrote called The Financial Advisor's Dilemma. And if people go to Business Ghost and drop us an email, I'll send you a free copy of it just because you stuck it out listening to me kind of, you know, blabber on about publishing. But that's and we're going to use that book, The Financial Advisor's Dilemma, as a means of attracting financial advisors to what we do and explaining to them how a book can benefit them and why they need it and how it can overcome the problems they have prospecting and attracting clients and again, achieving trust and standing out from the pack. So that's really kind of where we're headed next here.
It sounds like you're really taking a page from Michael Gerber's playbook. He was our July Entrepreneur of the Month. I really enjoyed his Awakening the Entrepreneur Within. And when we interviewed him, he was talking a lot about how he was maximizing his core skills and getting people to pay him to do for themselves what he had done for himself. So I think that's an interesting thing, and I'm sure plenty of financial planners will be interested in that. So thank you so much for your time, Michael. It's really interesting. We'll continue, I'm sure, to publish some of your articles as they fit into the Be Incandescent entrepreneurial focus. And we wish you all the best.
Hope, thank you for having me. I truly enjoyed it.
Great, great. Well, this is Hope Gibbs, your host on the Incandescent Radio Show on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Be sure to check in every Monday for our new podcast of the week. And if you have a great story to tell, be sure to send me an email at hope@hopegibbs.com, and we'll get you on the show. Thanks again, Michael, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you again. It was my pleasure.
This is the ePodcast Network.